listeners. My name is Elka Smirl, Program Director, Baranjinang Aboriginal Employment Strategy with the Victorian Public Sector Commission and a member of the IPA Victoria's Aboriginal Advisory Committee. I was born and raised in Victoria. However, my family came from South Australia, and I am a very proud descendant of both the Kaurna and Noongar people of the Adelaide Plains and the York Peninsula. But I am very pleased to be representing IPA Victoria today and its Aboriginal Advisory Committee in this very special Public Sector Perspectives episode. Today, we will continue the insightful and moving discussion that was recently had at IPA Victoria's memorable International Women's Day Gala Dinner on March 8. Firstly, before we begin, I would like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people and pay my respect to their elders, past and present. I recognise their continued connection to the land and waters of this beautiful place and acknowledge that they have never ceded sovereignty. I also extend that respect to my own community and to all traditional owners across this state and to any of our mob who may be listening to this recording today. To celebrate International Women's Day, 1,300 people came together in person to not only celebrate women across the public purpose sector, but to hear from exceptional speakers about a critical topic, the opportunity of treaty, truth and voice. IPA Victoria led a momentous discussion with exceptional First Nations women who were at the forefront of driving Victoria's historic treaty and truth-telling process. The audience on the night also had the opportunity to learn more about the treaty framework in Victoria. This episode therefore focuses on First Nations women who are exercising voice to take on decision-making power. So without further ado, I want to take the opportunity to welcome back our guest speaker of that night, Ellie Patira, Deputy Secretary First Peoples State Relations from the Victorian Department of Premier and Cabinet. Ellie was appointed as Deputy Secretary, First Peoples State Relations within the Victorian Department of Premier and Cabinet in April 2021. Ellie is a lawyer and policy advisor with broad experience across constitutional, Indigenous and minority rights, law and policy both domestically and internationally. As Deputy Secretary, Ellie is responsible for an extensive program of priority work with First Nations peoples in the area of treaty, truth and transitional justice, self-determination and cultural rights and protection.
Thanks, Elka. Wonderful to be with you today.
Thank you. Well, Ellie, I for one am excited to continue this discussion. So to begin with, Ellie, could you briefly explain the treaty framework in Victoria and its significance for the community?
Absolutely. We've been on a treaty journey here in Victoria since 2016. So it's been 7 years since treaty first came on the agenda. And, you know, a lot of people have questioned, why aren't we in treaty negotiations right now? And I think one of the exciting things about the way that Victoria has structured its treaty process is really allowing First Nations communities from the ground up to design not only to have a seat at the table during negotiations, but to actually design up what that table looks like. And that's where we've put so much of our efforts over the last 7 years. I think from a community perspective, there's two really key standout elements of the treaty process in Victoria. One is the establishment of the First Peoples Assembly of Victoria, a representative body for Aboriginal people in Victoria, accountable to Aboriginal people in Victoria, and responsible really for carrying the voice of First Peoples through treaty negotiations with the state. And that's incredibly new for us. You know, self-determination is a collective right, and in order to exercise that meaningfully, we need to have a representative body to express our views to the state. And so that's one of the important, really important elements from a community perspective. The other is the framework itself, which supports both the negotiation of a statewide treaty, acknowledging that we can exercise self-determination collectively as Aboriginal Victorians, but also allows for the negotiation of local treaties with traditional owner groups that pertains particularly to country and acknowledges the authority and the rights of traditional owners when it comes to matters to do with country. And so having come this far along on the journey, we've worked out what are the rules for treaty negotiations, who can negotiate, on what topics? What's the process look like? That's called the Treaty Negotiation Framework Agreement that has been agreed between the state and the First Peoples Assembly. The next is a treaty authority. The importance of that is having an independent umpire in order to make sure that negotiations are fair and equitable in the way they move forward. Again, an incredibly exciting institutional arrangement for First Peoples, because we have found so often in negotiations that our bargaining power is so unequal that we really aren't able to come to the table in a way that meaningfully supports our rights, and a treaty authority and having that independent umpire really makes sure the state is held accountable for its conduct. And the final piece of the puzzle is a self-determination fund that has now been agreed, again, giving independent resources to First Peoples, managed by the First Peoples Assembly, in order to make sure that we have equitable footing in treaty negotiations, but also to be able to build for our future. So the idea of a future fund with money to invest in matters that meet Aboriginal expectation and aspiration.
That's amazing, Ellie. I'm so excited to hear you speak that way. I had the good fortune to be able to go along and meet the candidate a couple of Mondays ago, and it was absolutely gobsmacking to see the breadth of talent that we have in Victoria for those that are actually going to carry this entire new way of living for Aboriginal Victorians here. I can't begin to express how excited I am. So hearing you talk about those very important elements, those three very important elements, is really exciting, and we're very lucky to be in good hands for that. I'd like to ask you, Ellie, what do you think some of the specific implications of treaty are, and what sorts of reforms and policy work do you think will result from it?
Well, I think first and foremost, treaty is an entirely different way of thinking about the relationship between First Peoples and the state. So I would say historically there's been very much a benefactor-beneficiary relationship. The state holds the purse strings and the decision-making power. It makes decisions often for the good of First Peoples, but certainly there hasn't been First Peoples in the driver's seat making decisions about matters that impact our lives. What treaty contemplates is setting out a new structure that allows for the transfer of decision-making power and resources to First Peoples to exercise through our representative bodies. And so that requires a complete mental flip for the state, because what it requires is the capacity to let go of control and to let go of decision-making power that for so long has sat with government to First Peoples to make important decisions. So it's a structural piece first and foremost. It's about deciding how and when First Peoples will make those decisions and what power sort of sits with that. I think in terms of policy and some of the downstream elements, that becomes part of an ongoing relationship, an ongoing structural dynamic that allows for decision making, and most importantly, it will be a matter for First Peoples through their representative body in an ongoing way to be able to determine policy, to be able to determine certain arrangements, particularly as they relate to matters that that are important to us, and that's the fundamental shift that happens through treaty.
Amazing. And Ellie, what does this piece of work specifically mean for your role as the Deputy Secretary?
I think it's an evolving space. It's absolutely no mistake that in 2021, when we established the First Peoples State Relations Group in the Department of Premier and Cabinet, we didn't call it the Aboriginal Affairs Department or group anymore, because there was a real acknowledgement that Aboriginal affairs doesn't happen in government. Aboriginal affairs happens in community. And what the role of government is, if we acknowledge that we are now in this new relationship with First Peoples, where we are acknowledging sovereignty of First Peoples and the right to be politically represented, well, our role becomes one of an equal relationship and building an ongoing relationship of equal partners, each holding their own decision-making power relating to certain matters. And so that name, First Peoples State Relations, is really trying to acknowledge that evolving relationship and my evolving role. I represent the state. I see myself as an important an important piece of the puzzle in terms of providing frank and fearless advice to key decision makers on what I am hearing from our First Peoples representative body on matters that they would like to see movement on and that they would like agreement and decisions to be made in relation to. And that's a really wonderful position to be in, I think, because it's no longer requiring me to kind of almost be a pseudo-representative. You know, that's a really difficult position that a lot of Aboriginal executives have find themselves in over time, being seen as a mouthpiece or a voice for an entire community. That's an impossible position to be put in. And so I'm very excited and happy to move into this evolving relationship of kind of holding a relationship with the representative body and making sure their views are reflected to the most important decision makers in government.
I can hear the excitement in your voice, and I think you've got probably the best job in the state at the moment as a woman who is able to actually drive this piece of work. And now I know how the name change came about for First Peoples State Relations as well. Totally get this is about no longer being the mouthpiece of government, but actually having that, as you say, frank and fearless discussions and providing that advice that, you know, government absolutely needs every single day. The next one that I have for you, Ellie, is so this is a little bit about you. You've held various executive positions in the Aboriginal Affairs portfolio within the Department of Premier and Cabinet, and also you previously worked as an academic in the corporate sector for Aboriginal organisations and as an advisor during the Fijian constitution-making process. With all that wealth of experience, what are some of your career journey highlights, and what do you say is potentially the most your most proud work that you've delivered in that space?
It's really interesting when I think about my career, because rather than seeing it as particular highlights along the way, I see the person that I am now, the role that I hold now, as very much the collective outcome of all of those different positions that have all brought different skills and knowledge and ways of thinking that have really helped me, I suppose, to be influential in pushing on treaty and truth. So I would say, you know, I started my career as a corporate lawyer, and I learnt about being really robust in my legal reasoning, in how to legally draft documents, in how to read those documents, an incredibly important skill when you're negotiating treaties and drafting treaties. I worked for Aboriginal land councils, and there I learnt the power of listening to Aboriginal voice and making sure that it is the collective voice of Aboriginal people that is represented through to key decisions. So that self-determination element. I learnt in academia the importance of really looking broadly at expertise available and being able to distill that and practically deliver it on the ground. And so I'm very much the sum of all of those different experiences along my journey, without a doubt, and it's obviously very easy to say in the context of a podcast, particularly considering treaty and truth, but those two pieces of work are without a doubt the matters that I've worked on that I'm most proud of being able to deliver. You know, I've talked already about treaty setting a new relationship, about acknowledging a sovereign to sovereign relationship between the state and First Peoples. Treaty is about setting in place a robust voice and power for our people that will impact for generations to come. And I can't think of anything that I could be more proud of than being able to feel that impact into the future. And equally, I think it's not only about the fact that we're delivering on treaty and that we're delivering on truth, but I'm proud of the manner in which we're doing it. I think it really is having regard to international best practice. I think we are really honouring self-determination and creating an equitable playing field. And the truth-telling process is you know, equally an area in which we've really pushed the gauntlet in terms of what's possible. You know, we have set up in Victoria, in partnership with the First Peoples Assembly, a royal commission So with the full powers of a royal commission able to look into not only historic systemic injustice perpetrated against First Peoples since colonisation, but also ongoing systemic injustice. That's an incredibly powerful institution through which to bring about better knowledge and understanding amongst all Victorians about the history of this state and the reality for so many First Peoples in terms of the intergenerational impacts of colonisation. So, you know, two incredibly meaningful pieces of work that I am so proud to have worked on.
That's amazing. I think you being a lawyer and having that background certainly has provided such an amazing platform for all the work that you are currently doing and rolling out in your department. It's an absolute credit to you, Ellie. So this next question is around what are the strengths and what are the challenges of being a First Nations woman in the service? And what advice can you impart to other women and First Nations people in this space?
One of the greatest strengths for any First Nations person working in the public service, and I know, Elka, you know this all too well, that we come with lived experience and with an incredible passion and drive and desire for change, for transformation, to fundamentally question the status quo and make sure that we are delivering better outcomes for our community. I think what you get in a First Nations public servant is someone bringing their whole selves to work to make change, and that's such an incredible strength. I think equally, you know, what sits alongside that is necessarily the challenges when you are talking about status quo and transformation, because I talked before about feeling, you know, it was an important role of mine to be translating what the First Peoples Assembly is talking about, their representative voice into government. But necessarily that requires me to hold a mirror up inside government at times and really sort of drill down into, well, what is it that we do now, and how is that tied to colonial structures? How is that tied to systemic ways of thinking that have historically excluded Aboriginal people? And those are really difficult conversations, Elka, to be having, particularly at the senior level of government. And they are often uncomfortable conversations. You know, they're conversations about structural racism. They're conversations about unconscious bias. And I think one of the great challenges is working out how to do that in a way that both respects and honours my community, while at the same time being influential within and trusted within government. And that's an ongoing balance, and something that I reflect on so regularly in my work. You know, ultimately, I think community keeps us all honest in terms of how we play that role in government.
Yes, I'm just having a little moment there thinking about how community does keep us honest. In my own reflections, but it's, you know, I think it's a privilege to be able to hear you speak so honestly and down to earth in terms of it isn't easy working in government at all. And when you are, as you say, you're the one who has to project that message from community all the way back to government, and it is correct. They are difficult conversations to have, but you're in such an amazing driving seat to be able to push those things through to government and really land this treaty where it needs to be. So thank you for sharing that as well. Amazing stuff. So this is a pretty multi-approach question for you, Ellie. There's a few of them, so I'm just going to break it up a little bit.
Sure.
What is the importance of self-determination and decision-making, and what would you like to see going forward?
Well, Elka, when it comes to the right to self-determination, both international and domestic evidence shows us so clearly that when you put Aboriginal people in control of decisions that impact our own lives, we're able to come up with solutions and policies and services that really address the issues that we know impact our communities at alarmingly disproportionate rates. And so I'd say first and foremost, self-determination, Aboriginal-driven policy, decision-making and outcomes is entirely critical to improved social and economic outcomes. And that's why it's so important. What has been missing for so long, not only in Victoria, but in Australia, is having that representative voice. We have ever-strengthening Aboriginal services. We have, the Victorian government engaged with a range of partnership forums that are asked for advice, or they're asked to consult or to engage on any manner of portfolio issues. But the fundamental change that comes about through self-determination, which I say can be best delivered through treaty, is that opportunity for a representative body accountable back to our own community in the driver's seats around those decisions.
In keeping with this theme, particularly the theme from International Women's Day, what are the specific opportunities do you think there are for First Nations women as a result of the treaty process?
Well, I think one of the most exciting elements of the treaty process is that we are building institutions from ground up by First Peoples for First Peoples. Often when we're trying to bring about measures to deal with issues of gender inequality, we're often tinkering at the edges of existing patriarchal systems and trying to find, to put in place all manner of measures to create a more equitable system. I think that idea of being able to institution build from the ground up means we're actually able to take into account a gendered lens on how we build out these institutions in the design phase. And we see that in the Assembly itself. So the Assembly has a membership requirement in its constituent documents requiring equal representation of both men and women in the makeup of its chamber. So we know that there's equitable voice in its very design. And the Assembly has really taken that forward in all of the other elements of the treaty process that is then negotiated with the state. So I talked earlier about a treaty authority, the independent umpire for treaty negotiations. Not only will be that be an all First Nations body, so an authority and an umpire made up entirely of Aboriginal people who are making decisions in accordance with law and cultural authority. The Assembly was also absolutely adamant that that treaty authority had to have equal gender representation in its membership as well. And again, Uruk Justice Commission, when it came down to the matter of commissioners, again, we saw that same lens applied. And so we're seeing it. What we absolutely are certain of is that we have that equity represented in the membership of each of those institutions. And we anticipate necessarily that the flow-on effect is that the agreements that are reached through treaty, the policies that are implemented by a First Peoples representative body necessarily will have that gendered lens embedded within them by virtue of the members sitting at the table making those decisions. So it's an incredibly exciting and I think quite new space to be in, and one that is, I think, particularly unique to the circumstances in which we're working.
That's very insightful. And I think it's fantastic to be able to see that this whole process is looking at men and women equally in the space. We know, for many of our women, we all come from a matriarchal family line, and it's just good to see that that is going to be continued on for the future. Lastly, Ali, what do you think allyship looks like for non-First Nations peoples?
So allyship is such an important part, I think, of the journey that we're on, because we are talking about fundamental change, both at the national level through voice, but also in Victoria through the treaty process, that requires not only First Peoples to be heard, but also requires other institutions to be able to listen and to be able to think differently and to be able to give up control and to be comfortable with shared decision-making or transferred decision-making to First Peoples. Often to get to that place, we have to look at what the status quo is and how that has disproportionately impacted First Nations people. And I talked earlier about uncomfortable conversations around structural racism and those sort of matters. And I think what good allyship looks like is someone who's actually first and foremost able to self-reflect about who they are in the space when matters are raised around transfer decision-making or changes to the way things are done now, takes an open attitude to those, listens to those voices in the side that says, huh, that sounds risky, or, oh, we've been making that decision for years, and actually reflects on, why do I feel like that? And what does that mean about where I'm at on my journey? Because I think even some of our best allies, I think when it comes down to the pragmatic shift, it's different and it's uncomfortable and it requires different ways of thinking. So I say to allies first and foremost, self-reflection is really important, understanding your own lived experience and values that you bring to being able to assess whether a particular aspiration put forward by First Peoples is valid or not. You need to take into account what you bring to the table and how that impacts your perception of change. And then as much as possible, listen openly to First Peoples, and wherever possible, listen to our representative voice. I think it's incredibly important not to get into a mode of saying, I know this one Aboriginal person who said. We have representative voices, we have representative structures for a reason, and that's to make sure that the absolute and very important diversity of our community, because we are so diverse, is able to be heard and is able to be reflected in all, you know, ways of being moving forward. And so to good allies, I really challenge not only that self-reflection and deep listening, but a real openness to coming along and meeting our representative voice.
Beautiful. I absolutely agree with you wholeheartedly on the allyship kind of traits and values that we need to have for those who are walking this journey with us. Self-reflection, understanding lived values, and assessing and validating what you bring to the table. They're amazing. I've pulled those out and I'm going to hang on to those for the future, Ellie, and really being able to tell our allies to challenge themselves and to deep listen. That's very important. We forget to do that from time to time, I think, ourselves. So very valid reflection on what allyship really looks like for our mob. Ellie, thank you so much for this engaging and thoughtful conversation. I've absolutely learned a ton in this, and just having these few moments or these few minutes with you in this process from the very beginning of 6 or 7 years ago when it was first considered even a thought bubble in the minds of government. I do actually recall that day. And to see how far things have moved along and being Victoria being a flagship, I suppose, of sorts for others around the country, but also being able to be in a fortunate position to see the good and bad about treaty negotiation too. So it's been absolutely a pleasure to hear your thoughts, your knowledge and your expertise about what was, what is and what will come. And I know we've got an absolute gold mine in front of us in terms of everything that our people can see now more clearly and be together as one and be able to, as you say, self-determine what we need to have as Aboriginal people in this country. So thank you so much for that, taking the time to share your personal thoughts and reflections, and what a great topic to be exploring with you especially. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Elka. It's been a pleasure.
This podcast follows the conversation at IPA Victoria's International Women's Day Gala event. IPA Victoria will continue to foster discussion about treaty truth and voice in a variety of meaningful ways in the coming months. You can stay in touch with what we do by following us on LinkedIn at IPAA Victoria or on Twitter at IPAAVIC. This program is produced on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I'm Elka Smirl, and I thank you for listening.